have a quorum yet, but I'm not about to start late as a result. Representative Burrell, if you'd like to go first and start explaining your bill, and once we have a quorum, we'll officially call the meeting to order and do the minutes, et cetera. So members, we'll start with House File 2087. That will be recommended to be held over for consideration for the data practices omnibus bill, as well House File 2160, Larson. The Holberg bill and the Coles bill will be moved to the general register. Representative Burrell.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and thank you for the honor of appearing before our committee. The 2087 is a data practices, government data practices bill. It has three sections at this point. I understand it will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus data practices bill. Section one is stipulates that data on Minnesota Service Co-op's health and dental plans is non-public data, not on individuals. This is a similar change that we made last year to the U of M health plan data and surveys. Section 2 is from the Office of Health Facility and Complaints. It says that inactive investigative data on individuals that are maintained by the Office of Health Facility and Complaints that are not classified under Section 626.557, which is the Vulnerable Adults Act, are classified as private data on individuals. The department had a temporary ruling, and they'd like to make that permanent with this change. And Section 3 classifies preliminary and final market appraisals by city or independent appraisers of personal and intangible property to be non-public data, not on individuals, until a purchase agreement is entered into or until the parties negotiate in the transaction exchange appraisals. Madam Chair, I don't know of any opposition. I don't have any other additional testimonies. Mr. Gimberling is standing by if we have some specific questions that I certainly couldn't answer.
All right, thank you, Representative Burrell. And is it true these are the items that were given temporary classification over the interim that we have to act on? I heard you say that in reference to one. Are all three of them falling into that category? Or Mr. Gimberling, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
I will indeed, Madam Chair. Don Gimberling, Department of Administration. We have a kind of a different issue that I don't think we've ever had before. All three of these were approved as temporary classifications by the Commissioner of Administration, which then has to be reported to the legislature in bill form by January 15th. After January 15th, the Attorney General, who reviews temporary classifications for form and legality, disapproved the one from the Health Department. So technically, it was not in effect after that time. So I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that. When we talked to potential Senate and House authors about this and explained that situation, they were okay with going ahead, but I wanted everybody to know that that particular one was disapproved by the Attorney General.
And that would be Section 2 of the bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. The next item on the agenda is if Ms. Vaught will note the roll, the third item is approval of the minutes. The minutes before us are the minutes from the Wednesday, February 18th committee hearing. Are there any additions or corrections or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes are approved as distributed. Representative Burrell, would you like to officially move your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this time, I would like to officially move that House File 2087 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus data practices bill.
All right, thank you. Members, are there any questions for the bill author, Mr. Gimberling, at this time? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in favor of this bill? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill? Mr. Neumeister, if you'd step to the stand and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister.
Thank you, if you'll continue.
One of the many things that we have to become aware of is that there are hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who are getting older and becoming more involved in what they call the Office of Health Facility Complaints. Now, I think it's important to let you know what is the Office of Health Facility Complaints and the folks that they cover. Hospitals, nursing homes, home care providers, hospice providers, boarding care homes, supervised living facilities, and assisted living. So we have hundreds of thousands of folks going in currently and will be as the age increases of folks going here. And the issue for me is who is overseeing the investigations of these kinds of complaints, particularly the regulations that they receive complaints about and then are then done about and let's say whether or not there is some abuse or whatever. We want other entities, whether it be newspapers, whether it be citizens, whether it be, let's say, a relative of somebody, to find out if this office is doing their job, particularly with budget cutbacks and with the increase in population in this area. There needs to be some kind of middle of where there is some public accountability and public oversight. Throughout the country, if you go on the website, you'll see a lot of newspaper articles sometimes that pop up about horrible situations, and then what happens in response to that in some of the facilities I talked about or some of the things that are licensed by the health department, all of a sudden there's a movement for openness. That has happened in our state in some areas, like the child abuse area, where now a lot of stuff is now open in the court process to where there can be some accountability. Now, speaking with those folks from the Department of Health and with Mr. Burrell, and with this being pulled over, there's going to still be there may be some finagling to kind of meet that medium. One of the things, and I don't know if they were going to offer it today or not, because I wanted to comment. The health department, Mr. Burrell, were working on another amendment that would do some other things, but it's not before you now, so I can't, I cannot comment on that. But the way it reads now, I would oppose. So that's at least, we may come down this way again as language. So the basic thing, it's important for some type of public accountability, and if we can meet that medium.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Any additional questions for the author? Sir, did you want to speak it to this bill?
If you'd like some comments from the health department.
Certainly. If you'd step to the table and state your name for the record, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Oren. I'm the data practices coordinator for the health department. And we understand Mr. Neumeister's concern about accountability. The temporary classification that was granted by the Department of Administration by law could only cover the data as either private or confidential. It's a blunt instrument. It's not something that has any subtlety. And what we've talked to Representative Burrell about and to the Department of Administration is to try or to switch the language so that it refers to the Vulnerable Adults Act privacy protections. And that requires a public report. And the public report for a Vulnerable Adults Act would include the name of the facility and the nature of the alleged maltreatment and so on, so that there would be public accountability. And what would be protected would be the names of witnesses in particular. And that's what we feel strongest about, is that witnesses would not be inclined to talk to us if they feared retaliation. Right now, the name of the patient would be protected under the Patient's Bill of Rights, and the name of workers for that facility would probably be protected under the whistleblower statute. But witnesses, family members. So if you make a complaint, there's concerns that the facility might take it out against your family member who's in the hospital or in the nursing home. And that's what we really, truly want to protect.
All right. Thank you, members. Are there any questions for Mr. Oren? Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, yes. I just wanted to add an additional comment to that. There's something in the statute that refers to a lead investigation. And if if the person providing the care was not licensed, then the county would be the lead investigative unit, and that's kind of what brought this case about, was that the county was doing the lead investigation, so the data that the department was doing in alongside a subordinating investigation was not covered in the data. So this is why the reason for the temporary temporary classification. And when the county is doing that investigation, the data in the county investigation is already private. So you have a situation where the data that the county is investigating is private and the department's is public, and that's what this is hoping to close up, is that little loophole, so that when the department is doing it, the data is considered the same in both situations.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Comments? Anybody else in the audience would like to speak to this issue? All right, Representative Burrell, if you'd renew your motion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2087 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed,
aye.
Nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Burrell. Representative Larson, I thought he was in the room. Well, next we will go to House File 170, Representative Coles, and I misspoke. This bill, we will hear and take testimony on this bill today. Then we will, Representative Larson, why don't you hustle down here and we'll get you home earlier today, if you're lucky.
Well, I wish got City Council Member Steve Peterson from Bloomington joining us today. I wish I got to go home earlier. I get to, when I'm done here, I get to go to back to regulated industries. So.
Oh, lucky you.
So if you wouldn't mind if I stayed a while, it'd be fine with me.
We'll see how it goes. Representative Larson, I will move House File 2160 to be recommended for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. I see here that you have an A3 amendment. Would you like to address that at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
The A3 amendment is an attempt to narrow the scope of the bill. When we had spoken a few weeks ago regarding what my desire was to provide for data privacy as it relates to email addresses, the original language actually goes further than had been intended, and so I would like to have that amendment adopted.
And so just for clarification purposes, well, your intent here is that only the email addresses of customers
that's correct.
Would be made private.
That's correct.
Not all data.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The Section 1 part of the bill, if you go back to the bill, actually makes private data that identifies newsletter subscribers and their accounts and their subscription interests. One of the problems there is that as people are interacting with an electronic newsletter, perhaps showing what their likes and dislikes might be, that those folks not have that information be public, including their email addresses. And then the second part, where I think there was additional confusion, was as it related to how much utility data would remain public. With adopting my amendment, as I understand it, it would utility data would continue to be available. It's just that people's email addresses would not be disclosed if someone accessed that information.
All right, thank you. I think we'll deal with the amendment first. Members, are there any questions on the A3 amendment? Okay, I will move approval of the A3 amendment as distributed. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Larson, now if you want to describe in more detail the main portion of your bill.
Well, I think what I'll do, Madam Chair, is I pretty much have described it in terms of providing privacy to, I think as we move into an electronic, as we've been moving into and continue to move into an electronic age in how local units of government interact with its citizenry, we'll continue to have issues like this come to the surface. This is a case where, in terms of the newsletters, as the local units of government become more sophisticated in communicating, in interacting with citizens or having citizens interact with them, we're concerned about data being public that perhaps shows a citizen's interest in one topic or another based on their accessing a city website. And in addition to if they've subscribed to an electronic newsletter, that we not be releasing that information. As it relates to the utility customer data, again, I know there's a larger debate over whether or not utility customer data ought to be public or private, and I understand that's a larger debate. This just merely says, as it relates to that email address, that we not make that that information public. I think one of the things that we found, and I'll ask Steve Peterson from the City of Bloomington to address this, is that folks are perhaps less likely to access something if they believe that as a result of that they're going to be the victim of you know, enormous amount of spam.
I have a question in the way the language is drafted here. When you spoke to me about the bill, you talked about the email address as not being made available. I'm curious, the first part of that on line 10, data that identify a subscriber, as I read that, if somebody wanted to get a list of the names of the individuals that subscribe to the newsletter, that would be prohibited. Am I misreading this, or was that your intent? Or
Madam Chair, I think your description of that is accurate. Perhaps if it made the committee feel better, it would make it would perhaps not have the individual's name be private, but I guess what I'm really driving at is the account or subscription interests are private and the email address. Why don't we get some thoughts from Councilmember Peterson? He may have some perspective on that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson, if you'll state your name for the record.
And my name is Steve Peterson, and I'm a member of the Bloomington City Council. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll be pretty quick here. We have two initiatives in Bloomington that we're trying to make sure are things that people are going to actually want to do. One is we have the idea of building a kind of customized website that allows citizens to get information about their particular neighborhood, about what's going on in their neighborhood. We have a basic version of that running at our website right now that allows you to see development that's going on, road projects and things like that. What we'd like to be able to do is integrate that with content that we're already building for our municipal newsletter so that you could get customized content that would be emailed to you. That does two things. One is it lets people customize that content to their particular interests, and number two, it lets us avoid the cost of putting it in our print newsletter and mailing it to people. So we see it both as a service improvement and as a cost reduction measure. Not an enormous amount of cost reduction, but it's the sort of thing where if we can cut two pages out of our newsletter, which goes out six times a year, that saves us some money. So that's really the intention of the first section here. The intention of the second section is related to doing electronic billing. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but right now about 1 to 2% of bills in the United States are presented to people electronically. And when I say presented, that means like the part of the bill coming to your house. Some of the forecasts I've seen say that, you know, in 2007, we'll have on the order of about 15% of people receiving their bills this way. And what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to set up our utility billing so that we can ride this trend and save the costs associated with sending out the bills. The bills cost roughly 30 cents a piece to send out. We send them out every other month. And what we don't want to do is we don't want to build a really effective way for somebody to come in and do a request from us and get a list of email addresses and physical addresses and be able to use that for marketing purposes. And so that's our reasoning behind this, is to really prevent that from happening.
All right. And then, Ms. Peterson, can you speak to the first part of the bill? Was it your intent that somebody would not be able to get a list of the people that were using an electronic newsletter versus their email address? Was that something that was discussed, or is this a drafting error?
I'd be comfortable with allowing the list of names to be public. What I'm trying to do is in the proposal that I've been pushing for is to kind of make it so that you can't make a request of the city, get a file with 2,000 email addresses, paste it in your email program, and press the send button and be pestering a bunch of people. And so I think if we're able to achieve that by modifying the language here, I'd be okay with that.
All right, members, so it's not necessary to modify the language at this time, given that it'll be held over, but it's something that we should have some discussion about. Representative Larson.
Madam Chair, with that in mind, Mr. Carlson from MICA has also raised the issue of the fact that we identified as municipal electronic newsletters or data, and they'd like perhaps some clarification that includes all local units of government. That's something we can keep in mind as we look at the omnibus bill.
All right, thank you. Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, I think my question might be to that point exactly. Representative Larson, the word electric was stricken on line 16. So, and maybe Mr. Peterson can answer this too, is what if people are paying their water bills or their garbage hauling electronically, and that's electronically transferred? Good.
Representative Burrell, we did adopt the A3 amendment. It's probably when you were in transition from presenting your bill to getting back to your seat. So as we're viewing the bill right now with the A1 amendment adopted, the electric is back in.
Madam Chair, I think that was my point.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Electric might need to be left out, so it'd be any municipal utility, not just their electric. So it could be water, it could be garbage hauling, it could be whatever else the city might provide.
So, Representative Burrell, what you're suggesting then is that you would support the names and addresses on individuals who, say, do water hookups or whatever as being private.
No, Madam Chair, if they're emailing their bills or electronically paying their bills, then their email addresses maybe would be private, I think is the intention of the author here.
Okay, I think now I'm getting it. Your concern is that we're not modifying enough utilities with the electronic mail address, and you would want the electronic mail address to apply to all utilities, not just electric. Try again.
Representative Larson, jump in at any point if I'm not making your case adequately enough. Madam Chair, where anyone is paying, they're receiving their utility bill electronically, and I don't know if they're doing an electronic bank transfer, writing a check and dropping it off, but it's where the municipality is electronically transmitting their bill to them via email.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Burrell. I think I do know what your question is, and perhaps we can get some help from council, but I think the language accomplishes what you're asking. The section 2, as we had as the bill was drafted, was taking on a whole different debate that I probably didn't intend to take on when we started, and that was on whether or not that information should be available at all. All we're trying to accomplish in this, and I think that our language with the amendment does it, it says that as it relates to this data, we're protecting as private the email addresses for all municipal utility billing.
And if I might, Mr. Vierden circled the word any on line 4 of the amendment. So electronic mail addresses of customers who pay any municipal utility bill. And, of course, we've heard from MICA that municipal may need to be changed to something else. But I think what we're doing is, given that this is being laid over, you can work with it. Representative Burrell, if you'd talk with Representative Larson with your concerns, Mr. Gimberling, and Ms. Engler, I'm sure will be willing to help get us where we're trying to go here. Any additional questions?
Madam.
Representative Smith.
Councilman Peterson, this website that your city has created and maintains, I presume, are you doing that with city taxpayer funds?
Mm-hmm.
What problems? And so you're asking that this website that the citizens are paying for be in part private data and not released to those same citizens. Is that what I'm hearing?
Councilmember Peterson.
Councilman Peterson.
Thank you. The only part of the site that our proposal intends to make as be private is the email addresses of people who subscribe to information on the site. All the information on the site would continue to be public data. So it's just the fact that, say that you go into the site and you pick an address and you say, I want to know about any development that happens within a mile of this location, and I'm interested in knowing about park programs related to disabled children. If you select those facts, which would be your email address and the fact that you selected those preferences for your particular subscription, would be the data that would be private under this. The information about programs and the information about the development would continue to be public.
So, Representative Smith, it would prohibit data farmers from walking into the city of Bloomington and say, I want the email addresses of all the people that are subscribing to the Bloomington City newsletter, downloading those, and then sending them all the wonderful emails that many of us receive.
Madam Chair, Councilman Peterson, has this occurred in the past, what's just been described by the Chair? And if so, has it happened in the past? And if so, how have you met that question in the past?
Councilmember Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We don't currently collect this information because we don't want to have the information be available. So I don't have any specific examples of being able to say this is how this has happened. I can say that I went, as part of kind of researching the background on this, went out and identified what it would cost to take a list of real postal addresses and do an append of email addresses on it. And I found that the firms that were willing to do it typically charged between 25 cents and 75 cents an address to do it, and they had about a 15% match rate. And what that tells me is that if you could go to the city and you could get a list that had 40 or 50% of the email addresses matched against real physical addresses, that it would be a valuable commodity. And so it wouldn't surprise me to see people come along and attempt to get that data if we collected it.
Any additional questions for the author or witness? Anybody else in the audience like to speak in favor of this bill? Anybody in the audience like to speak in opposition to this bill? Mr. Neumeister. Welcome back to the committee.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Let's take a look at what is considered municipal utilities. Garbage, depending on the city you're in or the county or whatever. Telephone, water, electric, sewer, district heating, and there might be some other ones too, depending on the entity. Now, I have to give my credit to Mr. Larson for striking out electric. I like that. And just or keep putting electric back in. But one of the concerns I have now, and you've got to read it closely and think about the age that we're in of computers. Now, in terms of data that identify a subscriber to a municipal electronic newsletter, that information would be non-public. The question I have is whether it be city propaganda from a certain point of view, or maybe it's the truth, or whatever, about any of these things, public utilities. They're getting a story, but maybe there's a group of citizens who want to rebut some arguments that are being emailed generally by the city or whatever in some of these areas. You want that contentiousness to be able to get different points of view when certain kinds of things might be going out, but you don't know who's receiving it. Therefore, how can you rebut those kinds? Or maybe you want to give another point of view that can help certain kinds of things. So I think to make all of a sudden where newsletters are going to their emails, to make those private, I do have some concerns about that. The issue about who and the additional language and the electronic mail address of customers who pay any municipal utility bill electronically, fine. You know, you want to keep maybe account data private and those kinds of things. But once again, as time goes on, a lot of folks are going to probably be getting electronic mail addresses. So once again, the city has the data, the entity. They might want to put out all kinds of messages or whatever on some of these issues in some of the areas that I described. Sewer rates are always a big problem. Maybe they want to do something about something else. You know, the mind can continuously go on how localities do lots of kinds of things. So try and focus, if it's dealing with any financial kind of stuff, account numbers or whatever, it's for billing purposes, focus on that. But if you're using it to where newsletters can go out or other kinds of things, no. All my information have not. And it'd be quite expensive if I want to be able to, I could probably get the names and maybe the addresses and start sending things out. But I'd be at a disadvantage. Let's have free speech and good political discussion in the locals and not make it hard to do. And again, like you indicated, Madam Chair, if my impression of how we do these with the omnibus, the issue is basically discussed a little bit, and as time goes on, it may change, and there might be more thorough discussion later on. But anyways, I think that's an important factor to keep in mind. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the few moments of your time.
Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Thank you very much. Anybody else in the audience like to speak in opposition to House File 2160? Any additional questions by members of the committee? Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you. Madam Chair, maybe a question for Councilmember Peterson or Representative Larson. I'm just curious, as I think sometimes we get too focused in, is this electronic or otherwise? There are many municipalities out there that have a subscriber list to a newsletter that goes out by traditional mail, and suppose a message went out that I opposed. What is the current practice under Chapter 13? Can I go to the city and get a list of those who would subscribe to a traditional newsletter that went out through snail mail? Okay, I see a shaking of the head from Mr. Gemberling, and since he's at the top of the food chain for Chapter 13,
I'm not going to argue.
Yeah, that's right. None of us will argue, so I have my answer. Thank you, Mr. Gemberling.
Thank you. Top of the food chain. Any additional questions or comments? I'll renew my motion that House File 2160, as amended, be recommended to be held over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
And then we'll revert back to House File 170, Representative Poles. And this bill, we will take testimony on the bill, and then we will lay it on the table. There is, this particular bill, I understand, does not have a Senate companion, but there is a duplicate bill that does have a Senate companion that hasn't been introduced on yet, should have a bill number on Thursday, is that correct?
Almost, Madam Chair.
Next week.
Can I give it a try?
Certainly.
Once we, assuming the committee adopts the DE1 amendment, then it's identical to the new Senate file, and that Senate file's companion will be introduced on Thursday.
All right. So I would assume that at this time you'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Representative Coles, if you'd like to explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 170 is back before the committee. It actually passed out of committee last year. It sat on the general register after we adjourned. What the DE1 amendment does is it corrects an issue that was raised by Representatives Atkins and Pugh and Latz last year and the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. The new subdivision 2 of the bill provides that if a cause of action arises for a Minnesota plaintiff, that this borrowing statute or the other state's statute of limitations would not apply. I guess I can go back if the committee would like and explain the bill all over again, but we had some testimony last year. Essentially what this does is right now under Minnesota law, if a cause of action is brought in another state's substantive law is determined to apply to the cause of action, Minnesota courts say that Minnesota's statute of limitation will nonetheless apply, even though another state's substantive law applies. This is almost an anomaly. I'm not sure of any other state that has such a such a scenario. But what we have seen happen, and what has happened in the 12 months or so since this bill was before this committee last year, is a continuation. Jack Fribley from the Fagrin Benson Law Firm is here if members have questions. But his law firm has seen approximately one case a month over the last 12 months where a non-Minnesota resident with no connection to Minnesota has brought their lawsuit to Minnesota and used our courts after the statute of limitations in the state where that cause of action arose has expired. This bill would say that if another state's substantive law is going to apply, that that state's statute of limitation would also apply, except if you're a Minnesota resident, and that's what Subdivision 2 takes care of. That amendment was adopted by the Senate in committee last year, and that's the bill that's before the Senate and will be introduced on Thursday.
All right. Thank you, members. Any questions for the bill author? Representative Coles, how long do you have to be a resident?
You would just have to establish residency in the state of Minnesota. You would have to be a resident, however, at the time that the cause of action arose,
okay.
Which is what the Subdivision 2 requires. So you couldn't just move to Minnesota for the purpose of bringing your lawsuit here and say, I'm a resident. The language says if you're a resident at the time that the cause of action arises.
Any additional questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in favor of this bill? Anybody that would like to speak in opposition to this bill? Okay. Representative Coles, if you'd like to renew your motion.
Well, at this time, Madam Chair, I think are we gonna lay over the bill until next week? Is that's my motion then?
That works for me. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda is House File 2093, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2093 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And the first thing that I need to do is present an oral amendment, page 1, line 24. After the word subdivision, strike the numeral 2 and insert the numeral 3.
Any objections? Hearing none, so moved.
All right, and the next item that I would like to address in order to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss it is the 144 amendment. And this adds a provision to bring this bill into conformance with a closed meeting that there would have to be a recording of the goings-on when you close the meeting. It is fashioned after the language that governs closed meetings for labor negotiations.
Representative Holberg has offered the TS-144 amendment. Are there any questions for the author, any discussion amongst the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor of the 144 motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, members. With me today I have Grace Schwab, who works with the Minnesota School Board Association, and Mr. Deans. This bill was brought to me from the School Boards Association, but it began with the Lakeville School Board, so that's kind of how I think they ended up at my door on this one. As you can imagine, with a rapidly growing school district like the Lakeville School District, they are frequently purchasing and or selling property. As you can also imagine, in a rapidly growing area, land becomes very expensive as soon as anybody figures out that somebody might want to buy it. And so the problem that the school district was having is that as soon as they were considering purchasing property to build a new school, any of the landowners that got wind of areas that they may be looking for property, somehow that property seemed to begin to escalate in value. And the school board would like the opportunity to close meetings for the purposes of discussing strategy for purchasing and or selling property they might have. Members from the School Board Association will testify in favor of it, and I did have contact with the Realtors Association, and they've expressed no concerns with the bill.
Is Ms. Schwab up next? All right, Ms. Schwab, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I'm the Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota School Boards Association. We would like to thank Representative Holberg for bringing this bill forward. This is a piece that came through our delegate assembly process, which started with the Lakefield School Board and was forwarded to 150 school board members from across the state. They felt, out of all the positions, that this was one they thought should be part of our pink sheets that we lobby up here and share our concerns with you folks. And we're here today because of that initial groundswell from my membership.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Schwab? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. We believe that this bill is really close to being a technical change to the way people think that this should be done in the first place. If we're going to sell a piece of property, and if you want the school board to make some sort of a determination about what their selling price is going to be and what, you know, what they're willing to take, it's sort of like if you make a decision to sell your house. And if you want to put it up for $100,000 but you would take $60,000, you don't want to tell everybody. You don't want to put a thing on the front door that says, I'll take $60,000 but I've got it offered for $100,000. The same thing is when that's when you're selling, the same when you're buying. What your offer is going to be, if they come back with this, we'll come back with this. That just makes common sense, and that protects the taxpayers. You shouldn't have the person that you're selling to or buying from being able to sit and find out what your next offer is going to be. And then the third option is to review confidential or non-public appraisal data. That's data that's been provided that you've got, you know what your appraisal is of the property. So that's one of the items that goes into making that decision. I would point out that the actual purchaser sale has to be approved at the open meeting, and that the purchase price and sale price is public data that's certainly available to the public. And you have the taping amendment that's on. This is done the same way as the labor negotiation strategy one. That's worked well for years. It allows, if somebody thinks that they did something at that meeting that they shouldn't, they can bring an action. The judge reviews it in camera, makes a decision whether they talked about something that they shouldn't have had the meeting closed, and then it's a violation of the open meeting law. Otherwise, it goes on. We think that this is a simple bill, and thank you for your support.
Are there any questions for the witness? Is there anyone with us here today who wishes to speak in favor of House File 2093 as amended? Okay. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition of this file? Sir, please approach the dais and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, trade association of all the states. Newspapers.
Mr. Deans makes one good point, and that is public officials should have some latitude to not have to put the $60,000 purchase price that they'll take on the front door of what they're buying or selling as opposed to the $100,000 they're asking for. But this is not a technical bill, and this is not a simple proposal, because I don't have to tell any of you that real estate purchase and real estate sale issues are some of the most controversial and vexing matters that public bodies can take up. And this bill applies to all public bodies in the state. And we are deeply concerned that some of the language that frames up this bill will allow policy discussions about the sale or purchase of property with taxpayer money, after all, to go on secretly. And I want to be clear. I think the core of the bill is a reasonable proposal. Nobody, certainly not our association, thinks that this kind of range of sale price or purchase price discussion should be available to your adversary in the negotiation. But the bill, for example, on line 21 allows the government entity to talk about strategy relating to the sale. And similar language comes up on the next page. Where are the boundaries of those sorts of limitations? And what sorts of discussions might in the end be allowed to occur under that kind of authority? Now, Mr. Deans talks about the taping exception, which has been in the law for labor negotiation strategy for a long time, and that is a beneficial provision. We appreciate the amendment. But it isn't a cure-all, because Mr. Deans talks about if somebody thinks something improper was discussed at the closed meeting, they can go to a judge and get the tape. Who's to know what was discussed except the members of the public body in that secret meeting? And it's not feasible for citizens to go to a judge on any routine basis. That's a very expensive proposition. So it's a helpful deterrent, but it's not a cure-all. Our bottom line is this. I would like the opportunity to work with the author and work with the proponents of the bill to see if we can't tighten this up so that it will properly serve the public interest that is at the core of this legislation. But will then minimize the potential for taking away from public scrutiny very important discussions by public officials about whether they should buy someone's real estate or sell real estate they own, all with public money. So, thank you, members.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might,
Representative Polbert,
they're not secret meetings. I mean, there is a public notice that they're going to close a meeting, so the characterization that these meetings are secret I don't think is being fair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, if I can clarify, I meant secret in the sense that the public,
saying,
thank you, Mr. Chair, the public is not able to hear what occurs during the meeting. That's the only sense I meant secret in.
Are there any questions for Mr. Anfensang? If not, Representative Burrell.
I do. Thank you, Chairman De La Forest. My question might go along the lines of, as a former board member of one of these organizations that did close meetings for negotiations, if I felt that something kind of conspicuous went on at that meeting, I might contact a member of the public and ask them to have a judge review that record. I would think that would be the most reasonable way the public would be informed, is by one of the members more or less ratting out the board or the wouldn't that happen in your interpretation, or do you think the board is in collusion in secret and they're all in agreement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burrell, one thing I have learned over the years is it's impossible to fairly generalize about the behavior of public officials. So some will act collusively, but reporters get tips all the time from public officials. It's one of the biggest sources of very useful tips. You ought to look into this. You might want to ask so-and-so about what happened. But I think the basic problem with I emphasize again, this tape recording provision is helpful. It does deter improper discussions. But the problem still is, let's say I'm a reporter and I get that tip that the Metropolitan Council talked in a private, not a secret meeting, about a land acquisition proposal. And they talked about what land they should acquire and why, rather than just the price. It's still going to cost me $5,000 or $10,000 in legal fees to get that before a judge, and to get the judge's attention and to get an order, and that's a pretty high cost by which to monitor the public discussion.
Thank you, Representative Burrell. Did you have a follow up? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the witness, within this statute, what are the protections, if any, for the record made at that closed meeting? Protections for compilation of the record, the handling of the record? Is it taped? For how long is it held? Who has access to it? When is it destroyed? Does the existing statute cover any of the of those issues relative to the maintenance of the record at that closed meeting?
Mr. Anfensang.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, well, I think the Data Practices Act comes into play to a limited extent. I mean, the Official Records Act as well make public officials responsible to properly preserve a record, which the tape recording would be. but I don't think it's particularly detailed, and I think this language here would be more specific than anything else found in the law.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Smith. No. Okay, Representative Holbert.
Well, it's pretty clearly delineated in the 144 amendment. You have to keep it for 2 years. It has to be made public after the sale's final.
Thank you. Any other questions of the witness? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anfison, is it possible under existing law if the school district, for example, hired Mr. Deans to negotiate the purchaser sale, would existing law allow them to close the meeting to have the discussion under the attorney-client privilege?
Mr. Anfison.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I don't think it would, because there would not, but by and large, and here's another topic I hesitate to generalize on too much, but because the judges remind me constantly I'm wrong when I do generalize, but I think what you can say safely is there's got to be some sort of litigation occurring before the attorney-client privilege allows the meeting to be closed. So I think the answer is no, they couldn't do it for that reason.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of the witness? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify in opposition? The House
Thank
file
you,
2093. Thank you. Hello again, Mr. Neumeister, if you'd care to state your name again for the record and
proceed
with your testimony.
For the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Let's take a look on page 2, line 1, what strategy means. You can see where you can run a Mack truck through it. Strategy, according to the Random House of English Language, is a plan, method, or series of maneuvers or stratagems for obtaining a specific goal or result. In my point of view, that's a lot of discussion about a lot of things in order to want to purchase a piece of property or to sell a piece of property. Now, this will be all on tape. Now, first of all, I think it's important for the public to hear what I defined as strategy in a public meeting. But now, how, at least if the proposal and with the amendment, I think this is, I don't know what number it is, it's the TS-144 amendment, that the tape will be released only after it's been purchased or sold. So now it goes before the public body. It's approved for sale, and then technically the tape becomes available to the public. I think it's backwards. How can citizens be able to put good input to its public officials? It's not just the school board, but it's the HRA where I live in St. Paul, where if you look at their agenda, they're always doing a lot of these kinds of things. So I think in the broad term of what strategy is, the meeting, closing the meetings can be abused, and to where one cannot find a plan, the method or series or what was contemplated or the ins and outs for at least an informed public can discuss issues before the sale is done. That's not even allowed to them. So I think there needs to be some work on that. I bring to also at least a concern I have, and did you adopt the, was that, oh, okay, that one wasn't adopted, okay. Anyways, it's more than just the school boards. And I think that, and it comes down, this is just an element of how you feel about this, but if you live in a community and you know that the city wants to purchase some land, or sell some stuff or whatever, and it involves you or your community, I think you want to be a little bit more aware about it. But I think what the current language, proposed language does is keeping things in the dark. I may not say secret, but it keeps things in the dark. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I hope that Representative Holberg will work with citizens like myself and the Newspapers Association to fine-tune this a little bit, because I think it needs that. So thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Burrell. You got to raise your hand, friend.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't have a question for Mr. Neumeister. I actually ran across a question for the author of the bill and the chair of our committee. Representative Holberg, when it says public body, how encompassing is that? Yesterday we heard a presentation on the school trust lands and education policy, and the board that manages the school trust fund buys and sells land all the time. Would they close their meetings for these negotiations, I guess, or?
Representative Holberg.
I'm going to have to phone a friend.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gemberling. If you'd once again state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Don Gemberling from the Department of Administration. Any governing body of a political subdivision is subject to the open meeting law, and then a whole series of bodies that are at the state level that essentially constitute any kind of body where you've got more than a couple, three members that conducts business and meetings is basically subject to the open meeting law. They include bodies appointed by the governor, bodies created by statute. All of those kinds of things are bodies. The one you mentioned specifically, Representative Burrell, I'm not familiar with, but if it's something that's been created by statute and it conducts business in a meeting, it's going to be subject to the open meeting law. And executive branch entities, like a meeting of the Department of Administration staff, that's not subject to the open meeting law.
Thank you, Mr. Gemberling. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, is there any further discussion of this bill as amended amongst the committee? Seeing none, Representative Holberg will renew her motion that House File 2093 as amended be recommended by this committee to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. Motion is adopted. Members, it looks to me from the agenda that concludes our business for the day. Is there any other business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Holberg.
The rumble in the hallway is that the likely first deadline will be the 12th of March. Given that we are likely going to recess at noon on Tuesday, March 2nd, due to caucuses and our rural members needing to take a hike home, we will not be meeting on that date. So we would have one meeting date next week and two the following before committee deadline. It's unrealistic to think that given the number of bills that are heading it this way, that we would be able to accomplish the work in three meetings of under 2 hours. So I would suggest if you have any strong feelings about whether you'd like to work longer on any of those 3 days, if you'd like to come in on a Saturday, a Friday, I suggest that you provide some comment to me in the next couple days, because we're obviously going to have to add some hours to our meeting schedule, and would like some feedback on how you'd like to handle that. I would say at the very least, we'd have to have one, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock night, or add a Friday, 5-6 hours on a Friday, in order to accomplish what needs to be done during that last week. So let me know what you think.
Thanks, Representative Holberg. With that, the meeting is adjourned. The hearing is adjourned.